Welcome to the Mumbrella Podcast. I'm Tim Burrows. Now, if you're listening to this, then that is a very healthy sign, because it means that this pilot wasn't so bad that we had to delete it. Our thanks, by the way, go to CBS Interactive for use of their lovely, shiny studio. Anyway, this one is our first podcast. Give us some feedback, and if you like it enough, then it might just become a regular feature. We might even get some music and jingles and funky things like that. Now, joining me today is my regular, if we do more of these, a co-conspirator, Scott Rohde. Scott is a senior account manager at Sydney PR agency Zing, and he's also a former tabloid hack.
That's a little hat that I used to wear occasionally.
And we'll touch upon that one a little bit later. And also a little bit later, we'll be chatting to Jonathan Est of Journo's Union, the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance.
Hi.
Welcome, Jonathan. But first, we turn to this week's papers. It's a funny sort of rhythm, really, isn't it? Because all of the kind of media and marketing sections all break on a Monday. So we arrive at work and, you know...
First thing we do is just grab it and get into them.
First hack. And tell me, it's always a good test. Are you an Australian or a Finn person?
I have to admit, I'm usually straight into the Australian, I think. I'd like to follow up with the Finn, but yeah, definitely Australian's my first choice.
Well, let's start with the media section then. What caught your eye from today's Oz?
I think obviously the T-shirts and Twitter, Unite Jakarta Citizens, I found that really interesting to see how a lot of the traditional media are obviously pointing at Twitter and saying that it's, you know, just this fad, it'll go away and it doesn't do anything. And yet we can see that, you know, it's a viable option for news, it's a viable option for information, and it's a viable option for people to get in touch with anybody in the world, which is what makes it so useful at the moment.
Although I must admit, one of the senses I get, and I'm not saying it's particularly with this article, is you get a sense with all of the papers at the moment that suddenly a journalist discovers Twitter and you almost read the same story every two or three months as they discover the amazing usages of Twitter, and you kind of sense that you've read a fair bit of it.
Yeah, it's just like regurgitated story every time. Well, actually, funnily enough, I think there's two Twitter stories that seem to appear in the media. The first one is obviously the journalist finding it and exposing it, how wonderful it is. But on the flip side, there seems to be a whole bunch of jaded hacks who seem to say that's going to fail. And that's it. Yeah. And, you know, and they spend the next 400, 500 words saying, yeah, never going to happen. It's about people eating lunch.
Yes, there's many an article like that, isn't there?
I think you quite often, you can tell whether a media organisation has embraced Twitter or not as to the number of journos who suddenly start popping up going, hey, look at what I've written on such and such and linking you to their story. What I don't see a lot of are crowdsourcing journalists going out and saying, look, come. You know, I'm going to do a story about such and such, you know, can I get some case studies? Mm. And I'd have thought that would be a real key tool. I mean, obviously, marketing your work, it would be great for. We're not seeing so much. I mean, it was terrific to see this story about Jakarta, and you had the same sort of thing going on in Iran. They're really engaging with it, because I guess it's another way of getting those vital messages out and exciting for us. But you're right. I mean, I think there's a lack of an understanding of what Twitter is, you know, and it's seen as a bit of a threat, perhaps.
And I think, again, with journalists, you're right again, it's not so much the reaching out at the research stage, or it's often not, it's that transmission thing, it's for blasting out your story when you finish.
Yeah.
You know, it seems to, which I'm totally guilty of myself, I must admit.
But I suppose I'd like to see, down the line, that journalists are using it to outreach. I've not even seen one journalist actually put out a little thing saying, if you've got an interesting story, why don't you contact me? Which is strange. You would think, you know, that's a perfect medium for someone to say, actually, here's a direct message, here's a tip-off.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I must admit, I do get direct messages which tip me off to stories. Well, one we'll chat about a little bit later, which you were peripherally involved in. But let's, by the way, if you want to follow Mumbrella on Twitter, we are at Mumbrella. If you want to follow Scott Rohde on Twitter, he's at Scott Rohde. And Jonty, are you?
I'm at Jonty98.
So Jonty 98.
Yeah.
So that's nice and easy. Moving on within the sections, I'll tell you one story that I had a bit of fun with, actually. This is a little bit inside, was just that journalistic thing of, I think there was a little bit of a blunder when the photograph was taken. There's a story about an agency called Droga 5, which is a Sydney ad agency. And it's that classical photo of, you know, the two sort of senior people hard at work, and they're kind of looking through a glass thing, and there are various kind of post-it notes stuck to the glass of a project they've been working on, and it's fine because you're backwards, but the ink has sort of come through, and then sort of backlit by the flash, you can read the post-it notes. And based on that, certainly the theory that I posted on Mumbrella is the particular project they're working on is one of the guys in the photo is actually New York based, and he's done this amazing thing called the Millions Project, or the Million Project, which is about basically getting kids back to school and getting them to stay in school by rewarding them with mobile phone time. And lots of the little post-its seem to be about technology and mobile phones and doing things for the community. And then the third from last paragraph in the story mentions that they're working on a community project for Telstra. So the journalist in me wants to put two and two together and make five, but I'd like to think that the same thing is going to happen over here.
I saw that on Mumbrella yesterday and went straight ended up poring over the thing to try and read what the messages said. But I thought that's one of those classic things where you get the shot, you stick it in the paper, and then it gets printed, and you think, oh. And I expect the guys in the ad agency went, oh.
But it also, the way of things being as they are, you know, I've no idea whether the reporter went to the agency in person or not. Sometimes the reporter does the conversation on the phone, the photographer goes and takes the picture, and sometimes the first time the reporter sees the picture is when it appears in the paper.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
So never the twain shall meet sometimes when you're out in jobs.
Mm. Absolutely. What else caught your eye, Scott?
I've got to admit, I found that little Canberra still mute on Chef's TV tirade article quite interesting, talking about how Gordon Ramsay, obviously a man from my own country in my own town, how he managed to swear more than 80 times in a 40-minute episode. Now, he uses the F word, and as there's a lot of young marketing students out there, we won't use the F word because we don't want to upset you. But I just feel it's strange that, you know, what's the difference between once, twice, three times, 80 times? I mean, surely if somebody said something once, there you've heard it. What makes 80 times different from 40 times, 20 times?
Well, it's a different conversation anyway, but to me it's about using it for emphasis. Mm. And when you're using it 80 times, you're kind of probably losing your emphasis anyway.
Well, not with the way he says it, I find. That's a personal thing.
I suspect he could say flam, though, and he could say it so aggressively that he'd scare the hell out of me, I think.
Well, I think obviously, I mean, he's built his career on swearing at people and, you know, being very aggressive in the way he speaks. Yet for me, the way he speaks is like the way my mother spoke to me when I was growing up, you know, and my dad, because
not that it's done you any harm.
No, not at all, but it's just the way it is, you know. Sometimes, you know, in Glasgow you grow up and people swear. All adults swear. I just don't understand why the TV the regulars are kind of going, well, it's a bit strange.
And I suppose the other wider issue about this story as well is the reason for it being in there is complaints, I think, from the opposition that ACMA don't seem to be acting on these recommendations. And I don't know whether to feel sorry for ACMA or not, because they've been obviously been sucked into the whole Kyle and Jackie O thing as well. And it's, you know, I must admit, my sort of feeling as a journalist is the press release will drop every few days of some investigation to something that happened in, I don't know, a TV station in Perth a year and a half ago, and it finds that maybe they breached the regulations, but then that's sort of the end of the matter. They find that there's a breach, and generally there's no fine or anything like that. And there are these different levels of sort of seriousness. So it almost feels like usually it's very much a slap on the wrist.
Yeah, it's kind of toothless tiger effect. I think it was when I was in the UK, there was a number of organisations that were very similar where they wouldn't, you know, they'd whinge about stuff and complain, but they would never actually do anything that would make any difference to the companies.
Or often wouldn't have the abilities, because I think it's got to be, you know, if it's serious enough and it's a breach of the next level of regulations, then they can act. But, you know, similarly, I guess you have the Advertising Standards Board here, same story, they'll come out, they'll say it's a breach. Again, we wrote a story on Mumbrella a little while back about a brand called Wicked Campervans. You're probably familiar with them. They just have breach after breach after breach, but they don't care. You know, I could be wrong, but I suspect they're not members of the Australian National Advertisers Association, for instance. So the fact that they've breached it again, you know, you read their responses and it's comedy.
And it's lovely stuff, isn't it, for them? I mean, you know, we all know about Wicked Campervans now as a result. And I think with the particular example of Gordon Ramsay and ACMA, I mean, you know, they're in a bind, aren't they? Damned if they do, damned if they don't. I mean, there's a story there saying, you know, what are they going to do about Gordon Ramsay swearing a lot? Well, you know, what if they did say, well, we're going to ban him? You know, I mean,
yeah, an uproar.
Yeah, and he's not going to be that bothered. I mean, what I love about Gordon Ramsay is not so much the swearing, and I think he uses, you know, the F word and various variations on that in a gloriously creative way. But the, you know, is more his sort of abuse and the kind of the bullying, which in a sense I would find a slightly more sinister than just the use of a band kind of epithet kind of
thing.
I
don't know. I might come to his defence a little bit on that because it doesn't feel to me like it genuinely is bullying. I mean, obviously the stuff that he was doing with Tracy Grimshaw arguably would be, but a lot of what you saw go on in the kitchen was him being a perfectionist and him being very, very focused on what he wanted in that little tight environment where you can't afford to get it wrong.
Well, that's right. I mean, I remember reviewing a show of his 10 years ago or something, Gordon Ramsay's Boiling Point. And I watched this and I thought the amazing thing is that none of these sous chefs has decked him because he was so cruel to them. And then I read somewhere that actually the people that have worked with Gordon Ramsay think he's fantastic and, you know, they'd work again with him like a shot. You know, he tends, apart from, I think, Marcus Waring, who they don't speak anymore.
Yeah, I don't think it was about his sort of in-kitchen behaviour, though, was it?
No. I think it's monetary maybe or something.
Yeah, it might be. Yeah.
I mean, I would look back on the news editor who did me the most favours as a young journalist was the scary, shouty Scottish one.
Yeah.
Oh, was he? Possibly the same one that I had. Yeah,
I think so. There might be one who just moves around the, you know, moves around the newsrooms. And just on the watchdogs and regulators, I suppose, just to sort of close the loop. I get the same impression. I've not followed it as closely, but the Press Council, again, similarly, they can say that people have breached it.
What I know most about the Press Council is that they've just been undergoing a restructure and
much smaller council,
much easier to get consensus. You know, they're hoping that
smaller budget.
Yeah, that was a bone of contention, I gather. You know, the publishers on the one hand were saying, look, you know, we're sacking journalists. We really can't afford to be paying all this money to a. It wasn't so much the complaints, and this is the what I'm assured by the publishers is that they want a strong complaints mechanism for a lot of reasons, not least political. You know, they want to be seen to be, you know, kept in line and doing the right thing kind of thing, because obviously they don't want to be legislated to be kept in line. They want it to be more an industry-based thing. The Press Council also does lots of advocacy, and it does the State of the Australian Media and various different things.
And that was a kind of annual report.
Yeah, and I think the attitude was very much that why are we paying for someone to do this when we're having to lay off journos left, right and centre, you know.
I suppose that actually kind of leads on to the back page of The Australian when they're talking about sources being sacrosanct for journalists, when obviously we've got Women's Day and New Idea both guilty of publishing invented celebrity tales.
This is Mark Day's column. Yes, talking about that.
Which was quite interesting.
It is. It's an interesting dilemma because there's the double dilemma there of they're also trying to force out whether there even was a source as well, you know, or whether it was within the imagination of the paper, which certainly I think Crikey has been arguing was more likely to be the case. But yeah, the problem is one can disapprove of the fact that one's a suspicion of the story, but surely one supports protecting sources in all circumstances.
I think that's still one of the most important things to a journalist. It was drilled into me when I was studying and then when I was working that, you know, you never reveal a source. That's just the way it is. If you have to go to jail, that's what you have to do.
You don't even tell your bosses the source.
No, you don't.
You know. So I think what's interesting is that, you know, this idea that perhaps we saw this in the Gordon Gretsch case, the idea that because the source had misled the journalist was then free to give up the source.
Yes, and Godwin Gretsch gave an interview on the record first, didn't he, as well? Yeah. Was it Steve Lewis, I think,
Steve Lewis,
the guy who then discussed his source. I suppose the only issue I have with it is a practical one, just that thing of I would find, as a journalist, a lot easier to say to future sources, I have never ever given up a source.
Yeah, exactly.
Apart from saying, well, there was that one time, but there was a really good reason why not, when you're trying to persuade someone to talk to you.
That's one side of the argument that was aired. The other side was that in different countries, and I can't...
Canada was one of them.
Yeah, they have
Media
a different
Watch
type of media law, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to be of the thing that, you know, sources are absolutely... It's almost the first thing you learn is you don't give up your sources. Mm. And there are no degrees of that, you know.
Yeah, there's not a... No, I just gave him up because he was he was a bad guy. I think that no matter what happens, for a journalist... Your sources are your lifeblood for stories.
That's right,
so
yeah.
You need to be able to ensure that they will not be given away to anyone.
I mean, one thing I would like to say is that this country needs to introduce some proper legislation to reflect the fact that, you know, at the moment the legislation says, and in fact, I think the judge in the Harvey McManus case said, you know, it's all very well having this, you know, collegiate code whereby, you know, you think you can defy a court and refuse to answer questions, but... You know, and then he found them guilty of contempt, which I think I'm right in saying in McManus's case meant that he couldn't go on a prime ministerial trip to America because he had a criminal record. So we really need the current suggestions don't go far enough. It still leaves it very much in the judge's discretion to see what's in the public interest or not, kind of thing. And I think there really needs to be some, you know, we need to look at. The fact that for journalists, you don't have the choice. You know, you cannot name your sources. Otherwise, journalism won't work.
Mm, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Anything else that leapt out at you at all from there, Scott?
Oh.
Where you're looking, I'll point to one more thing, which is, I was just quite kind of amused in a couple of bits in the diary, Amanda Mead's column. I just rather love the competitiveness of... You know, it feels like old style journalism. You know, you've got Nine being, they've got a couple of different stories. They've got kind of Nine being cheeky and, you know, making promises. In this case, it was after the Kokoda air crash, sort of saying yes, it's pool footage, but you know, kind of then being first to air it before sharing it with everyone else. But then at the same time, you've then got Nine doing a deal with the Oz to share a photo if they give their car a push, but. The Oz deciding that because the car wouldn't start anyway, that the deal was off, so they're not getting their photo. So, yeah, it's kind of nice to know that sort of level of competitiveness is actually still going on. And
I think the competitiveness breeds a good level of kind of, if they're going up against each other and they're actually, you know, they feel that level of competitiveness, then they'll actually work harder at getting people to view their shows and things. I mean, you've seen in the UK the level of competitiveness in the newspaper industry is...
It's intense.
Yeah, it's intense. You know, you've got journalists, you know, you've got 10, 12 newspapers hunting for the same story, trying to get an exclusive angle, whereas, you know, you find a lot of times in Sydney you've got two newspapers, same in Melbourne. So I suppose that level of competitiveness is a little bit smaller.
Yeah. So most outrageous dirty trick you've ever witnessed without giving... away any names?
That's a tough one. I've seen journalists pretend to be from other newspapers. I've seen... there's one I really can't speak about. I've seen one journalist make up a quote on the spot from someone who had kind of pidgin English and then come up with a fake name and... All of the journalists agreed that they'd all use the same quote because they couldn't get a quote for a story.
Yeah, there's lots of that. No, I mean, I must admit, even, you know, working on local papers, this was in the UK, you know, I knew of one journalist who, close to the deadline of the paper I worked on, which is a weekly paper, and also the deadline of the rival, because they both went to press about the same time, leaving a house with a great interview while the other journalist was in the house, letting down the tyres of that journalist's car.
Oh, so, yes. Love it. There was a Fleet Street, London journo who was well known for carrying a pair of marigolds, they called rubber gloves, in his pocket so that he could go through the bins of people that he was looking around at. So when everybody else was on the front doorstep, he was around the back sort of donning his marigolds and going through the bin. And it yielded, you know, remarkable results. I'm surprised they weren't all doing it towards the end, actually. But.
Well, there was a guy in the UK known as Benji
the
Bin Man Pal,
wasn't
it?
Yeah, that's
yes.
Right. Yeah.
There's a publication called Private Eye, and his adventures used to appear in there a lot. I'm just turning to The Fin. and again, the media marketing section. I suppose just one thing to focus on, really, which is television. And it almost sort of highlights the kind of contrary nature at the moment. On the one hand, you've got that massive success story that was MasterChef. Mm. But on the other, you've got the horrible commercial realities at the moment of, you know, all of the commercial networks. But here, the editor of the marketing section of the Fin, Neil Shoebridge, is saying that Nine in particular are still having to discount their airtime rates, you know, whereas maybe Seven and Ten are kind of coming up a bit. Do you both still find yourself watching much of free TV? Do you still make that appointment to view?
Not a lot, to be honest. I mean, obviously, I watch, you know, some of the essential shows and things, but I do find that a lot of the time, it's you know, a lot of the shows are from the US, and they're 2 years behind. Obviously, yeah, and they're obviously talking about in the Australian media section about the whole tackling the face of human of piracy damage. And, like, you know, there is a lot of people pirating things these days because, why wait 2 years for a show to appear?
Yeah.
And the internet age has created this generation that wants something now, today, and not 2 years away.
And I wonder whether maybe with 10 playing to that younger demographic, that's something that affects them in particular because, you know, for instance, you know, by the time Flight of the Conchords came on and then didn't rate terribly well, you know, I seen it through somebody else's DVD they probably downloaded or something, you know, 6 months before.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think that's an issue. You know, again, you know, Dexter has just returned to 10. It's a series that has been on pay TV already. Then just to absolutely make sure that all chances of people watching it start, advertised time are going to air 9:40. Time it finally came on air, 10 p.m. to the second. And, you know, it's all of those things where it's planning scheduling tricks because you think that the game is with other broadcasters, but actually it ends up just, you know, perhaps switching off the viewers.
Well, something actually I find strange about Australian television is you watch something like a movie and the movie finishes, but then you get 2 minutes of adverts and it cuts to the credits.
Absolutely crazy.
I just sat there baffled in my chair going, did I just miss something? Was something that should have been there?
Yeah. Abusive, almost, isn't it? I can remember that my favourite horror story was watching, I think it was on Nine, Silence of the Lambs. Now, I'd seen it already in the cinema, but my then partner hadn't. And in the scene where she's going around in the darkened basement and she's being trailed by the bloke with the night vision goggles, and it's really, really tense, you know, and you're freaking out. It went to ads. Oh. You think, how the hell can you do that? I mean, what crazy person, you know, and I just, that sums it up for me, you know, the sort of lack of any kind of sensitivity to what a viewer might want.
Yeah, it feels like the short-term tomorrow's ratings is more important than the longer-term
relationship
of the viewer of the channel, you know. We had a guest posting on Mumbrella a little while back from someone who many, many years before had worked for one or two of the networks. He was just making that point is, you get to the point where you start talking about every brilliant new film as being, you know, it was a huge smash, and readers, you know, or viewers rather start kind of turning themselves off to the trailers because they just stop believing them. So that's perhaps an issue that television is maybe facing generally.
Could be,
look,
yeah.
I think this is going to be a key thing for all sectors of the media because choice is obviously exploding. We can have things when we want them, in what format we want them. It's going to be the quality of the experience that you offer to your audience. And I think if networks take the mickey, then people will vote with their feet. If they think they can get away with showing series, I mean, I forget who's going to carry The Wire. Well, that's, you know,
SBS 2.
But it's been, I mean, I've got all five seasons on DVD. I'm working my way through them. It's a fantastic, fantastic show.
Wonderful show.
I wouldn't want to watch it with adverts. And look, most of the people I know have watched five series of it, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, although I suppose I'd say, what, in defence of that sort of programme or programming, I remember that on pay TV, I think it was Channel W, or in fact maybe even W2 was the one that worked for me, did 5 days, five nights a week, from series 1 through to series 7, The West Wing, and you just got in the habit of, you know, you'd almost fall asleep watching an episode of The West Wing, and that worked quite well, and I could almost see The Wire working in that same way. But I'm actually not sure whether, and I don't think they've said yet, whether they're going weekly with The Wire or daily.
See, I think daily is the way to go with certain shows. Like 24 should be, if you, my perfect plan for 24 is hold it back till the season's complete and release 5 episodes a week, and that, because that sucks you in.
Not just broadcast over 24 hours.
See, that'd be even better.
Yeah, although it's 18 hours, actually. But it is. It's only it's because I bought one of the series and I looked. I totted up the time and it's 18 hours.
That's the thing, because each episode is, once you take out the ad breaks, it's sort of 46 minutes or something, isn't it?
I had the pleasure. I'd never seen it until January, and then a month off before I started up my new role, and I watched seasons 1 to 4, I think, and I was like, my other half was like, can you just stop watching 24?
No, that's the point. You can't.
Excellent. Well, look, we've talked vaguely around what the papers are doing. So let's turn to the Mumbrella Podcast first official guest, Jonathan, who we've been talking to already. Jonathan Est, Communications Director of the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, better known as the, or certainly better known to journalists as the Journalists Union. Now, Jonathan, you're a former newspaper journalist, both here in Australia and in the UK. I must admit, I still get, you know, I still consider myself to be a journalist, but I always get very spiky when people call me a former journalist. Do you still think of yourself as a journo?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I have very little truck with these fancy titles, and if, you know, we do a lot of presentations and a lot of things, and I always sort of say it's just a fancy way of saying I'm the in-house journalist for the Alliance, you know, and I've always enjoyed that, you know, like John Hartigan said, I grew up as a journalist, I'm a journalist, and I hope I always will be a journalist.
Yes, it was his first words of his, I forget which the speech was, a year or two ago, was named John Francis Hartigan, profession journalist.
That's right.
And I apologise if I've got his middle name wrong, because I can't remember that. Now, I guess it's almost impossible to avoid reading something about the future of journalism. If you look at any media website at the moment, you know, it's the big issue on everyone's minds. But I guess you're kind of trying to move the conversation on a bit at the moment, really, aren't you?
Yeah, you're right. You can't look at any kind of, let's put it this way. There's a roster of well-read blogs, most newspapers, you know. Journalists like to talk about themselves, and now they've got reason. Let's put it that way. So we have, for the past couple of years, been doing quite a lot of work on this, because obviously it is, you know, that people are saying it's the biggest restructure of the news industry since the printing press was, you know, movable type. And really, I mean, I don't think anyone anticipated to the extent to which the internet and digital technology was going to disrupt, you know, the journalism on all fronts. And it has disrupted the very thing that has sustained journalism for the last couple of hundred years, which is the advertising that's always paid for the journalism. People sort of suffer under the illusion that, you know, by forking out $1.80 or whatever for a newspaper, that's paying for the journalism. Well, that doesn't really even cover the cost of printing and delivering it. It's the advertising. And the advertising has, to a large extent, certainly waned. Let's put it this way. I wouldn't say it's disappeared. I've got some numbers here. And it's not forecast to come back for some time. In fact, I'm looking down
the... I suppose the question is, isn't it? Is it just part of the economic cycle, or is it a structural change? And that's the billion-dollar question, really.
Well, that's the sort of sickening double whammy as well, because not just as the major disruption of the technology has hit the industry, so has the global credit crisis. So, you know, you've been hit, assailed on all sides. In fact, I think Mark Scott from the ABC called it a perfect storm, and he's right. And I'm looking at the Australian print advertising market, advertising newspapers. Peaked actually last year, although you wouldn't have known it with the number of journalists that were being sacked. But, you know, it's forecast to go down by, significantly for the next 4 or 5 years, and then just start to recover. But I haven't seen it forecast to recover yet to where it was last year. So, you know, meanwhile, digital advertising is going to describe a sort of steady 12 to 14% growth each year. So a lot of people are kind of hanging their hopes on getting a slice of that digital advertising pie.
But one of the arguments about that is scale, you know.
Nowhere near the scale.
Yeah, I think, I can't remember if it was Richard Freudenstein from News Limited or John Hartigan, but one of them made the point that for every reader, that you maybe were able to get a dollar's worth of value out of advertisers in print, it's probably only worth about 10 cents in online. So
yes,
you've got to reach 10 times as many people to even be on the same playing field.
Exactly. And at the same time, we are still only talking about literally 10% of the total market to newspapers online. It's 10% of the sort of total kitty. The other thing is that the metrics for measuring, you know, people's clicks, I mean, the industry itself isn't terribly, the advertising industry isn't terribly comfortable with the information they have. You know, if someone clicks on to something just to, I was reading Peter Preston, former editor of The Guardian this morning, and he was saying, you know, teenager might click into The Sun to get a look at the page three girl for 2 seconds, and that counts as one unique user. Mm. And someone might click on to, you know, the Australian's media section and browse around, and that's one unique user. So, you know, the business sector isn't that comfortable yet with, you know, knowing how the advertising is going to work.
I suppose the same could be said about a newspaper, though. Some people will pick up a newspaper and then look through the first 15 pages and never look at the marketing section. They might never look at the sports section. So there still is that. I mean, there's never been a, I don't think there's ever been a time when you could say that if 700,000 people read a newspaper, they don't read every single story and they look at every single advert.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, I mean, people would have described that as a sort of great con trick, because, you know, the whole idea of a newspaper was a bundle of stuff, including, you know, the cartoons and the crosswords and the weather and the TV guide and the foreign bureau that you're paying for by the people that have just bought the newspaper to see what's on telly tonight and do the crossword. It worked very well in our favour when it was a bundle of stuff, and it's just that bundle is fast falling apart.
And it's becoming more and more of a debate as well. You know, the advertising agencies, and it eludes me why they're taking so long to be demanding this, but the media agencies, the guys who actually do the planning of the advertising, have finally started making quite serious noises about sectional readership, because at the moment, you know, there are surveys done that can tell us, you know, broadly how many people read as opposed to buy the Australian, but it doesn't then say section by section what those readerships might be, you know, and the same for all the other publications and magazines as well. So it sort of surprises me a bit that it's taken this long to get to that point where people are asking seriously for sectional readership, but
yeah,
that could be bad news for some papers.
It could, yeah, and also I guess with online metrics, once they do work out who's looking at what and for how long, you know, they will know. Mm. So, you know, it might be that everybody goes, oh, well, that investigation we spent, you know, we had 20 journos spending 6 months doing it, and nobody read it, you know. Obviously, one hopes that the investigations that take 20 journos in 6 months are the ones that attract. I mean, the Telegraph in England, for example, with the MP's expenses scandal, sold, I think, 1 million extra copies as a result of that.
Although, so I don't know if you heard the latest stats, because they have just they've just put some new stuff out in the last couple of days, because they changed the rules on bulk circulation so much. They've actually had an overall drop in circulation despite this amazing triumph, because they're having, you know, they're not having the ones given away at airlines and at hotels.
It took about 100,000 out of their overall figures, didn't it?
Yeah, which is so depressing. Yeah. You think, you know, that could have been their, you know, journalism's great triumph. And it's that usual thing, it stops them from looking too bad instead, I suppose.
And I'm not sure how bulks are measured in Australia, because I know that various newspapers give out a lot of their newspapers.
Yeah, so. And the rules have just changed again, so that you can bundle a package now. So the idea being, you know, you go into news agents and maybe buy a chocolate bar and get your newspaper free, but that might still count as a, you know, count as a bundle
Jolly good.
Purchase.
So they should. Know. You know, I think it's sustenance of a different
more
kind, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's right. So anyway, we had a big 2-day conference in Sydney last year. We got Roy Greenslade in from the UK, and we had various people by satellite, a bloke called Phil Mayer, who's a sort of eminence grise of American journalists, who came in by satellite. And really, they spent 2 days going, oh dear, the newspaper industry is in serious trouble. And I think a lot of people here went, oh my God, you know. And our feedback from a lot of people was that it was a really, really important thing that we did, but that it had left quite a lot of people a bit despondent, a lot of particularly our, you know, our members, journalists sitting in newsrooms going, ah, the future, it's going to happen to me and my career kind of thing, and it's not necessarily a good thing. And we kind of firmly believe that, you know, while there, you know, you can be forgiven for taking that point of view, that actually journalists are actually faced with, you know, in a glass half full or a glass more than half full kind of way, a fairly unique opportunity to be part of the restructure of their own industry and actually to have an influence on the way the industry turns out and works. And if you think about the sort of technology we've got command of these days, it's got to be good for telling stories and for we just talked about Twitter and using Twitter to source new information. The way we can publish is much more vivid, much more immediate. We can reach far more people. The horrible irony is that those opportunities are being presented at a time when there's no money. So, you know, we kind of hope that we can get through this.
Well, we talked about this yesterday. Jonathan and I had a coffee, and I think I made the point then that. But one of the great things about these things is they're cheaper alternatives. You know?
Yes.
So the money isn't the absolute thing. You know, you're able to communicate with a mass audience more cheaply than ever before.
That's right.
As a journalist.
Yeah, frustratingly, you know, it's the other thing, the other sort of fallacy that people say is that, oh, you know, with the downturn in the advertising dollar, that all they're actually losing money. A lot of newspapers, most newspapers aren't actually losing money yet. Their profits have fallen. The big problem has always been the debt structure a lot of them are in. You know, they've got to meet payments.
This is sort of globally in the US.
Yeah. I mean, much more in the US, and we're not doing it as tough as the US or the UK yet, and it doesn't look like we will, because the global economy has not turned out to be in such a deep hole as we thought.
But also, the newspaper groups here don't seem to be in the same debt situation.
I think Fairfax had debt issues, and I think
Stokes obviously has some.
But
also has a big pile of cash as well.
Well, exactly. So you kind of, and what we really want to say to publishers is that, I mean, obviously, you know, if you're run by your balance sheet, then that's a tough decision to make. You know, your revenues are going down. You've got to keep your returns up, you know. But we would sort of urge publishers to sort of think in a slightly longer term. The future of news organisations is really bound up with getting audiences, and you get audiences with good ideas. And if you think that a newsroom, you know, has got a couple of hundred, you know, one would hope fairly bright people sitting there, they're an ideas factory, really. I mean, we're trying to sort of say to publishers, look, exploit your workers more. Work out how to get more value out of them. Don't just think of them as being something that you can cross 10 off the list and say that's saving us money. Think of how they can make you money.
That's the union policy, exploit your workers.
Well, yeah, I was wondering about that one.
Yes, I've chose my words rather interestingly there. But, I mean, I think to an extent, work out how you can get more value out of them. Mm. And one of the interesting things that Campbell Reed, who's the News Limited Group editorial director, said at the conference we had last year, was that the big challenge is going to be not so much for individual journalists, but for news managers, how to manage journalists properly. And, you know, there is a feeling in the industry on all sides that actually any failures have very much been a failure of management over the last sort of 10, 20, 30 years even. Mm. It goes back to what we were saying before about the free-to-air TV as well. It's about the quality of the experience you're giving people.
I suppose the other question as well is, it sort of feels to me like the issues facing the newspapers now, it tends to put the journalists, the union arguably, the management, far more on the same side than on opposite sides than perhaps ever before.
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, it's all about we've got to get through this, you know.
Well, that kind of takes me back to my days. I mean, the thought of one of the journalists who I work with leaving the office with their own camera would be unheard of, because you'd be taking a job from a snapper. But nowadays it's kind of the done thing that, you know, a journalist should have maybe a video camera with a still focus on it as well, because they have to be able to multi-skill and multitask. Whereas, you know, in my days, it was simply, you're a journalist, you go out, you get the story, you come back, you write it, and that's it. Nowadays, they have to take the pictures, you know, do the lot. And I think that the unions, especially in the UK, were very much not willing to let that ever go. They were very strong in ensuring that. And I think the changing technology and the ability for journalists to kind of move forward at the moment in their careers, they need to be able to do it all. And, you know, it's one of those things that, and the moment you can multi-skill, then people are going to lose jobs.
There's a couple of things rising from that, really. One thing, Roy Greenslade sat at our conference last year and said, oh, you know, with a digital camera, any reporter can go out and take the pictures, you know, that's no problem kind of thing. And that, you know, every year we have the Walkley Awards in November, November 25th this year.
In Sydney this time, isn't it?
In Sydney, the Randwick Racecourse. In fact, November 26th, I beg your pardon. And we give out these awards for photography, and you look at the photographs and they're fantastic. Mm. You know, these are really great photographs by talented people, you know, and the thought of, you can just dismiss that as being, oh, anyone can take a picture, you know, point and click with a digital camera. I think that's rubbish.
I agree with you. I think there's some of the snappers I've worked with, some of the best in the industry.
Yeah, and it goes back to quality. You know, one of the things that has proved really popular in digital on newspaper sites are slideshows that go with stories. You know, it's one of the things you can add value. Why just run one picture when you can run an assortment of really good pictures? You sack all your snappers, and you know, you're not going to get those quality slideshows. You know, and that's really going to make a difference, because people vote with, if they're getting something worth looking at, they'll come to you.
Yeah,
you know?
And it gives you, if you go on the slideshows running your site, you've got 3 minutes of focused attention.
Yeah,
rather than like 30 seconds to read a news story.
Yeah, I suppose part of the debate then becomes about just that sort of that good enough thing. On some jobs, a quick headshot is probably good enough.
Yeah,
and that's where the skilling up. God, that's a horrible phrase. Skilling up, training journalists, you know, writers to take a photograph in certain circumstances. Yeah. Probably there's an argument for it, or shoot video, obviously.
Well, again, that's another chance for me to beat the Alliance drum. You know, another thing we're calling for is for, we're saying to journos, you know, you've got to make sure you get the skills you need, because it's not just about taking photographs, doing film. It's also about understanding the whole multimedia, the new kind of journalistic landscape. But also really employers owe it to themselves and to their workforces to do that to an extent. And if they're not going to do it, well, the Alliance is preparing to roll out. We're mainly aiming this at our freelance members who aren't going to get it in newsrooms. But
and going back to the roadshow, so Sydney, Melbourne was sort of almost raising the alarm.
Yeah.
And then the sort of second half of the tour, so to speak, sort of how has the focus sort of changed for that?
Well, we roll into Perth on Friday, 5:30 at the ABC Studios.
Depending when you're listening to this, that's Friday the, oh gosh, that'll be about the 21st or
21st, yes,
of August.
And we have a special guest, Tim Burrows, from the media and marketing site Mumbrella.
He's okay.
And
a big adventure for me.
That's
first
right.
time in a
over in the Wild West.
Yeah, well, no, I've made Perth, but the Adelaide trip will be my first time in Adelaide. So.
And I think the idea we're purposefully having them in the evenings, because we've had them during the day before, and of course people are in newsrooms, they can't just come and sit and spend the day at a conference. We've tried on the weekend, and of course that was really popular, and so we're doing it 5:30 in the evening, because we want to actually get working journalists, you know, come from work to these things, and you know that we've got an array of really good speakers. We've got Stephen Brook, who's an Aussie former colleague of mine from the Australian, who's now the deputy editor of the Media Guardian, really knows his stuff about what's happening, you know, globally in the journalism game.
And for people who haven't come across it, does a very good podcast for Media Guardian as
yeah.
well. Mm. He's one of the regular voices on it anyway.
And so he's going to come by satellite from London. Tim, obviously, in conversation with Christopher Warren, our Federal Secretary. And then a really good array, really good cross-section of journalists, and then sort of academics and bloggers. Journalists to talk about how their jobs are changing. We've got sort of various chiefs of staff talking about what they want from journalists, what the skills they're looking for, how they think the job's changing. We've got journalists who are in the newsrooms to say, actually, mate, you're not giving us those opportunities or whatever. You know, hopefully there'll be a pretty lively debate going. And then we've got bloggers and academics to sort of say, look, you know, this is where we think the news industry really needs to be heading. But also to try and identify, you know, we hear a lot about journalistic niches which people will exploit. Well, the great thing about what we see as being the future of journalism is it isn't going to be confined to the mainstream commercial media. You know, there are opportunities which, you know, as we know, various people, websites are already building on. To identify these niches and to make money and to make a living as a journalist. You don't have to go and work for Fairfax or News Limited in Australia anymore.
Yeah, there are many alternatives now. You know,
yeah.
You can do it independently, or there's sort of independent media sort of popping up. Now, I suppose moving on to, I guess, almost the other side of the content coin is PR. I went the PR Institute did a little debate a few weeks back on that whole debate of, is PR and journalism, you know, two sides of the same content coin, which as I sort of alluded to already, Scott Rohde is going to be our regular industry commentator on this podcast. Scott, you now do PR as a living.
Yeah.
How different is it to life as a journalist?
I suppose it's quite different at times. When it boils down to it, you're still creating something and still creating content at the day. You know, you're just doing it for a client and then obviously acting as their intermediary between them and a journalist. But I like to think that public relations is about helping journalists, you know, helping them find the right stories that they might want, helping them give them ideas for leads, and, you know, basically just being the middleman, I suppose. I mean, I've been doing PR now for 4 years. Got to a point in journalism where I felt as though I'd really accomplished what I'd wanted to do. I'd worked for the Sun newspaper, I'd worked for Scotland Sunday, I'd covered the whole space shuttle disaster, that kind of thing, and came to Australia and wanted to kind of make a change and moved into, funnily enough, Network PR, which was my first PR role.
Which we'll get into that one in a second. Yeah, so Network, and then you went on to Zing after Network.
I went to Pulse. I was working on Xbox there, and now I'm working for Zing as senior account manager doing on the digital side of the business.
Zing currently PR agency of the year.
B&T PR agency of the year. Yes, got a lot of good clients that we work with, and I obviously do a lot of the digital side, which is working with bloggers and working with video bloggers, online websites, all that kind of thing.
So you were, so talk about Network PR. You're almost part of the story last week, weren't you? It kind of emerged that Network PR, PR agency with what, 10 or a dozen people at its peak, probably, is having a rethink. That the principals are going off in different ways, but Network PR will be no more as it is.
Well, Network PR New Zealand will still exist because they've got a much bigger organisation, and Grant, the CEO, is from New Zealand, so he's I haven't spoken to him yet, so I don't know what he's going to be doing.
So the way that this emerged was somebody at another PR agency interviewed somebody for a job who found out all about it. They then tweeted the message on Twitter. Isn't it a shame they're closing? Addressing that comment to you, intending it as a direct message, but unfortunately broadcast it to all of his followers, and very quickly it was retweeted,
and then suddenly I had lots of direct messages from people saying, what's going on, what do you know? And I was like, well, that. I think one of the most viable lessons from that is, you know, Twitter's a medium for communication. And you have to make sure you know what you're pressing if you want to direct message someone or if you want to speak in a loud voice to the whole world and all your followers. I personally have stopped using TweetDeck on the iPhone because it's quite easy to send a direct message as a normal message. So I've moved to Tweety, which you have to press a direct message button. It makes life a lot easier because I've seen it happen myself. And, you know, it might just be a normal comment to someone or maybe pitching a story. But when it boils down to it, I don't want that being out in the big world.
And I suppose the other thing was just, the speed of transmission. You know, everybody within the Australian PR industry knew what was going on in that agency within a couple of hours of that first
tweet. Oh, within probably half an hour. I mean, really, the amount of direct messages I received after that, and phone calls, and then emails, and I was like, wow, this is quite amazing to see the speed of something grow.
And this is the funny thing, you know, when we put up a story on Mumbrella, and it was probably 4 or 5 hours after the original tweet, and it felt like I was really behind the game. Mm. You know, that's how quickly things have kind of changed now. You know,
it's unbelievable. And, you know, I have to admit that Network PR was the agency that kind of gave my feet in PR. You know, I worked with FedEx there, worked in Kodak, and then obviously a certain movie company, which I don't know if I can name or not.
Feel free.
we kind of launched a lot of their digital stuff. Certain movies such as, like, I don't know, Transformers, Hot Fuzz, to give you an idea. And, you know, we really were, they were at the forefront of a lot of the digital PR at the time, you know, speaking to video bloggers and giving them content, which was obviously the key.
And this, to me, is the sense that there is almost the biggest change going on at the moment, is PR isn't just about talking to the journalists, the print journalists or whatever, you know, it's obviously social media is a new kind of battleground, but there's almost a new audience to reach, but also a whole new piece of territory that maybe ad agencies or digital agencies held before that PR agencies can kind of push into.
Yeah, well, I think there's a convergence happening very much at the moment. But I mean, back to your earlier point, I think traditional PR, you know, is first and foremost always going to be there. I don't ever see that going away. I just think that it now has to, that PR people now need to, like journalists, adapt their skills as well. They're going to have to work in to the traditional media and to the digital media, and realise that both of them are areas that, you know, that give benefit to their clients.
You're a bit of a kind of digital champion, I suppose, which again is one of those horrific phrases. But you're behind the Surrey Hills Twitter Beer O'Clock Friday night event exchange.
Yes,
that was the word. Or shitbox.
Shitbox, I think we just call it. Yeah, strange enough, it started out as just maybe one. Oh, I think it was three of us, myself, aficionados, HH, and Tiferef, that's their Twitter names, deciding to catch up for a beer after work. And Mal, his aficionados, came up with a kind of wacky name for it because we thought we'd do something interesting. And it's kind of grown in size. So every week we meet at the Clock in Sydney and we do this drinks.
The one on Crown Street in Surrey Hills in Sydney.
Yeah, we meet 6 o'clock. And last week, I wasn't there last week, but the week before we had 40 people. The week before that was 48 people or something like that. And it, just every week it seems to be growing in size.
Yeah, that week before was my first attendance and it felt like everyone you've been following on Twitter was in one room at the same time, you know. Sort of maybe not quite as big, because there's also this thing called Social Media Club Sydney as well.
Which has around 300 people attending each month. I mean, I do champion digital, I suppose. I find it an area that I feel very comfortable in. I've spent my entire life online. I used to moderate a games forum in the UK. I gave speeches in high school on William Gibson's book Neuromancer about cyberspace and how the future was all people talking and talking online and communicating. And my teacher, I remember saying to me, Scott, I don't actually know what you're talking about, but you're so passionate about it. I'd like to see her on Facebook now.
I'd agree with her though. Scott, I don't always know what you're talking about.
Well, yeah, I get that a lot. So passionate. Usually about 11 o'clock at night.
One thing that strikes me, we do a lot of work with an agency called EMC, Peter Lewis, who used to work at the Telegraph. And he gave a talk to a public affairs conference we had a couple of weeks ago in Canberra. And his thing is, this is the public relations industry, public affairs industry, can now start preparing to bypass the journalists altogether. You know, we can target our audiences directly, you know, specifically within niches, so and then get messages out to them directly, and who cares about what the journalists think? You can, and we, you know, obviously I listened to that with growing horror.
But
I guess that is true. I mean, if you think of not one homogenous audience, but a group of, you know, or an endless array of different audiences, just like your shitbox thing, or I was talking to GetUp, people from GetUp, and they were saying they wouldn't even bother going through the media, mainstream media, if they had a message to get out, because their networks are that that sort of, you know, alive and vital, that they can put stuff out through various, you know, Twitter, Facebook, all that kind of stuff, and it'll reach more people.
Or even video bloggers. You there was that case study, I forget who it was, but you did a competition with someone.
Oh, yeah, we did a case study with Toshiba. They gave us, we had some content of a video of a laptop. It was iced, and it was water turning into ice, and it was a Toshiba laptop. And, you know, I went to one of the YouTubers and said, well, I've got this piece of content. How would you like to give a laptop away, but get somebody to add their own music to it, and, you know, get them to get creative, come up with something? And I think that's one of the key things is, you know, dealing with bloggers or video bloggers or websites online, it's not about giving them, you know, just saying here's a social media release, here's a press release, I think it's about giving them something exclusive, some content that they can really give to their readers. Because when it boils down to it, bloggers are very different from a journalist. A journalist's going out with a story, a blogger's going out with a lot of times a personal piece, a personal opinion.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference between the two of them.
And tell me, which, and this is almost to wrap up, so I think we're probably, you know, we're reaching our
boring
time.
Boring people.
I'd never say such a thing. Journalism or PR, which is the better lifestyle?
See, that's a tough question. You can't ask that.
I'll be asking you as well, John.
I can tell you that as a journalist, I did some amazing things. I can tell you I got a great holiday to the Seychelles to do an article in the Seychelles, which I can't tell you how wonderful it is there. But, you know, in public relations, I got the first lot of journalists to bloggers actually to come along and people from forums to come along and actually ask Michael Bay questions for Transformers, which was massive, you know, to get people in. They were going nuts, and the journalists were sitting in the back just writing down all the answers because the geeks had the best questions. And you know, I met Megan Fox in her dressing gown, which was, I can just tell you right now, it's awesome. And you know, so I think both jobs have got their own, you know, failings, but they've also got really positive aspects of them. And I, you know, I could go back to being a journalist tomorrow probably, but I enjoy PR, which is why I do it.
Jonty, life as a full-time journalist or life as a communications director?
Well, I think first of all, you've got to say that both occupations have their own sort of craft satisfaction. So, you know, when you're working in public affairs, you can sort of think you can do a really great job on something. Just as you do, you know, as a craft journalist, you put together a really good, you know, well-written, or, you know, if you're laying out the page, doing your job really well brings its own satisfactions. I think there's nothing like the buzz of getting a sniff of a story and getting it into the paper and, you know, that adrenaline, and then filing it. And then the next day, you know, the ego thing of seeing it in print, you know, and you just think that is fantastic, you know, and then dealing with the ramifications and watching other people follow it up—that is worth quids. I tell you what,
and that's probably why journalism has a future as well.
Well, you'd hope so. Yeah.
To finish on that positive note, I think that probably does take us to the end of the first Mumbrella podcast. If you liked it, then do let us know. Email me, tim@focalattractions.com.au, or just drop by mumbrella.com.au and join the debate. My thanks again to CBS Interactive for providing the studio, to Jonathan Est of the Media Alliance, and to Zing PR's Scott Rohde. I'm Tim Burrows, and that was the first Mumbrella podcast. We'll speak again soon.